Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm JP Nichols, hosting this week, along with Jason Henricks, as Brett is still in Australia. Jason, we've kind of taken over the show while Brett has been on his extended road trip. Are we ever going to let him back on?
Well, you know, I think we're actually going to change his title. He's now going to be the traveling reporter. We're going to send him out to chase hurricanes, tsunamis, you name it. Wherever it's happening in the world, we're going to send Brett to be our on-the-road reporter. I think he is actually doing a bunch of interviews while he's in Australia right now, so it'll be great to get some more of the international content back on the show.
He is, and he will be back soon. And, you know, last week we did the show together, and I joked about having my NPR voice on because I was speaking low and quiet in an airport lounge. And now, if you're noticing that, I'm not putting it on. I think I'm catching a cold. I was on 8 airplanes last week, so I guess that's maybe not shocking.
But JP, just admit it. You're trying to get the NPR voice. It's your new thing. Quit apologizing.
Yeah, my new career in radio, because I have the perfect face for it. So today's a big day. It's the start of the World Cup, which matters a lot to me. Not so much to you. You're not a big soccer fan, are you?
Well, I actually, you know, get excited about World Cup. I love seeing the international competition aspect of it. And, you know, I actually also really love following the underdogs because it's a long enough tournament. And I'm actually really excited this year that Senegal is back after, I think it's an 18-year break, but I really enjoyed them back in 2002. You know, super strong runners, underdogs. They fight super hard. That's who I'm going to be tracking through the World Cup. How about you this year?
Oh, I think if I have to choose, and it's hard because there's so many good teams and good players, I'm going to go with Belgium. So there you go. I said it. So,
okay.
Well, listen, we got a packed show, so we should get started. This week's episode of Breaking Banks is brought to you by The Financial Revolutionist. It's one of our favorite sources of news and insights, and it's not just us. The Financial Revolutionist has been named one of the best tech newsletters by Business Insider. You can subscribe at thefr.com. And today's show is also brought to you by Provoke Management. The hosts of this and other Provoke.fm shows are some of the world's leading experts in fintech, innovation, the future of financial services. So if you want Brett or Jason or me or some of our regular contributors like Jim Maroos or Ron Shevlin to speak at your event or your company meeting, you can learn more at ProvokeManagement.com. Well, on last week's show, Perianne Boring from the Chamber of Digital Commerce talked about the evolution of blockchain and cryptocurrencies. And then Brett talked with Derek Corcoran from Avoka about the very real challenges that banks are still having today with relatively simpler things like digital onboarding. It was a great show, and it's definitely worth another listen. And this week, we're going to continue a little bit of that compare and contrast as we talk about the last mile of financial services. Always the least efficient part of any business, and it's no different for financial services. First, we're going to talk with Michelle Tinsley from Tinsley Retail Insights about branches and physical locations. Then in our second half, Jason talks with Mike Lavin, CEO of Currency Cloud, about digital delivery and blockchain. But first, we have some conference announcements. Jason?
All right. Well, so we're wrapping up the FinTechs Forum here in Chicago, a week-long anti-conference segment. And by say anti-conference, meaning it's not in one location and you don't attend the whole thing, but very disparate sessions. We actually have two live recordings for Breaking Banks coming out of that. One was with Michael Ventura, CEO of Sub Rosa, and his applied empathy as competitive advantage. And then, of all things, probably one of the most fascinating in a format that I loved, had Jason Kolb of Deas and I talked about us as humans being bundles of data, but we have no licensing agreement with the way the world acts with us. And so in the same way that we all click, click, click to ignore that iTunes licensing agreement, you know, in the future, are we going to have our own personal licensing agreement? So look for those in coming weeks. Speaking of weeks, FinTech Week is July 6th to 13th in London. It's where the world of fintech comes to the world's fintech capital to enhance the dialogue between established multinationals, innovation firms, disruptive startups, governments, media, and investors. And then August 9th, back here in Chicago, we have the Block Legal Conference put on between FinTechs, the Kent School of Law, and Jenner Block. Super interesting panel, including the director of FinCEN, to talk about the legal ramifications of the emerging blockchain and crypto space. October 9th through 11th is BII Beacon in Orlando, a great time to be down in Florida when it's not so hot. And this is the Financial Services Conference designed to take industry goals and challenges and break them down into actionable steps that are right for your organization, your team, and you. Now, you know, JP, you know this well. You were both going to be there as FinTech Forge to put on a rare public version of our popular innovation workshop, helping Yes. financial institutions go from the innovation petting zoo, better known as the FinTech petting zoo that I wrote about last week, to actually getting things done. And then I'm excited to see you hosting the BAI Global Innovation Awards. Disappointed to see that I am not up for one, but you know, I'm thinking if you were the MC, maybe you can just slip that envelope in. You can register that at BAI.org. If you have a conference that you'd like to share with our audience, hit us up on Twitter at BreakingBanks1 or email us at info@provoke.fm.
Great. Thank you. So, Jason, did you lose any of your cryptocurrency in the CoinRail hack?
Well, I actually liked it earlier, JP, when you called it the CoinRail hack. And so, no, I do not keep any of my crypto on the exchanges. But, you know, if you haven't been following, the South Korean cryptocurrency exchange CoinRail says they experienced a cyber intrusion, not to be confused with a heist. It's a much better branding than a heist. But they may have lost as much as 40 million in alternative coins. Now, as you can imagine, that does not bode well for markets that are volatile already. And Bitcoin, which is already down 40% for the year, dropped 10% of the weekend. And as you said, we had Perianne Boring from the Chamber of Digital Commerce on the show last week. And so later in this show, we're going to have her back to give us a few minutes on her take and to break down for us. What does the CoinRail hack mean, and what can consumers do to protect themselves? And we'll hear from her in the second half of the show.
Great. Well, I'm only going to talk about one other news story today because we have such a packed show. Our friend Penny Crosman from American Banker reported yesterday that Bank of America already has 1 million users for Erica, its AI-based digital assistant. It's been just 3 months since they launched it in March, and we talked a few weeks ago with Jim Marus and Ron Shevlin about internet and digital trends, and voice continues to grow. But B of A says right now, tap and gesture on their app is actually the way that most people are accessing Erica. Voice and text inquiries are used about equally after that. And so far, the popular inquiries are pretty mundane, mostly transaction inquiries. But B of A have also integrated its Better Money Habits, their financial literacy contest. So things like videos to help customers learn more about credit scores and budgeting. And it can also integrate with the bank's spending and budgeting tools. And they say by late summer, they're going to launch more sophisticated tools, such as telling customers things like if they have an upcoming bill due, if their balances are too low to cover those bills, if a subscription's expiring, or if their credit score has changed dramatically.
Well, I'm excited to see that the mainstream banks are waking up to some of the really innovative things that we're seeing coming out of the fintech challengers, that they're actually making their way into the mainstream now. And B of A's head of digital banking, Michelle Moore, said that they've been a little surprised by the language people are using to ask their questions, using slang like dough instead of cash. So super interesting, I think, to see, you know, with natural language processing, what are we going to learn about people's money habits when they're talking in the privacy of their own home versus, you know, their I'm in the bank voice or I'm talking to a customer service rep. So, you know, it'll be really interesting to see what we learn about people's personal interaction with money, which I think is a great segue into the first guest for today.
Yeah, it sure is. Michelle Tinsley is the founder of Tinsley Retail Insights, and she sits on the board of Quick Trip. It's a popular convenience store chain with 760 locations, but she also has a very deep background in technology and IoT at Intel and others, so she understands the digital as well as the physical. And you know, Seth Godin had a great piece on his blog this week. He said in part, car factories are a bit of a miracle. They make a complex, expensive device, and they do it close to perfectly. People love their cars and regularly buy new ones long before they need to. It's largely a solved engineering problem. But on the other hand, car dealerships are a disaster. Nobody likes them. They're scammy, stressful, and unpredictable. And when you run your dealership like a factory, you're not going to succeed. You know, retail has gone through such massive shifts with the push towards online commerce, causing massive disruption and driving large retailers like Sears to the brink of extinction and catalyzing pretty massive consolidation and closures in the industry. And then you see the leader of the digital pack, Amazon. They open new physical stores, both bookstores and now the checkout-free Amazon Go retail store here in Seattle. They purchase Whole Foods and strike partnerships with physical locations such as Kohl's. I mean, Michelle, how is the role of physical locations changing in this day and age?
Well, I think what the retailers are learning is that 85% of retail is still transacted in a store. So there's still a lot of the shopping behaviors where a consumer wants to feel in the clothing, the thickness of the fabric, see the exact color against their skin tone. They want to try it on, make sure it fits correctly. But even in things like grocery, even though there are a lot of ways to order online and get it delivered to your home, people still want to go and look at the produce and make sure it's what they would pick out. So I think there's still that part of human nature. We're still seeing, you know, only about 15% of commerce go through e-commerce. And really this blended new reality is going to be the way of the future, that a retailer thinks about how they reach that consumer across both the e-commerce and in-store persona.
Well, I'm curious, Michelle, with the banks and financial service providers you work with, are they thinking about it in that way in terms of both this merging and blending that goes on? Or what are you hearing from the banks when they're thinking about reimagining the in-person interaction?
I think, sadly, I'm still, you know, my circle of network is still quite heavy in the IT space with banks. They have a very clear problem solve. I think what we need to do is see more collaboration across things like operations and marketing. I heard you just talk earlier about how great B of A is doing. They actually announced yesterday as well that they're deploying more technology to invent these new customer experiences, and it's falling to the bottom line. They're seeing better performance on operational expenses as a percent of revenue. So I look at that and go, they're again a forerunner. I think if others look at what's working well for them, they would kind of look at that playbook as well.
Yeah, I mean, clearly that's something we've been talking about for a long time. The cost to acquire and serve customers is so much less through digital channels. And I'm still quoting 4 years later now. I was at Next Money in Singapore, and an architect said, you know, people always want to know what the branch of the future looks like, but nobody asks me what the restaurant of the future looks like or the beauty salon of the future. So we know that it's, you know, modern furniture and iPads and that sort of thing, but where do we really go from here? And I think you hinted at it already, Michelle, that it's not just redesigning the physical space. It's really all the interactions. And so maybe building on what you just said, because you talked about the technology, how does technology really enhance and make those physical interactions better, or how can they?
Well, yeah, what I coach my customers to do is start first with what does your brand stand for? And money and banking is so critical because it is such an emotional issue. There's a lot of pride in how you earn that money. There's a lot of emotion around how you spend it. And so you look at that and say, you know, how do we tap into those emotions of the consumer? What does this banking relationship mean to them? What do we want our bank brand to stand for? Then once you figure out the experiences you want to demonstrate that reinforce your brand, there's lots of technology to choose from. I very rarely run into a situation where there's no technology to solve the problem. There's usually 5-10 excellent suppliers that you could bid out. So it's more the getting very clear on what's your experience, what's your brand promise, you know, what are they going to stand for, and how do you engage your customers?
Well, one of the I was just going to say, one of the things that we talk about a lot is, you know, trying to keep yourself from the temptation of just chasing the shiny new technology, and building on what you just said, Michelle, I'm curious if you see that in the physical space too, right? There are amazing capabilities of virtual reality and beacons and all different kinds of things. Are you seeing people kind of just chase that because it's cool without taking into consideration those things that you said, starting first with what do you stand for and what kind of experiences are you trying to deliver?
Yeah, I think this technology treadmill started about 10 years ago when every CEO went to a cocktail party and heard they need an app. And next thing we knew, every bank retailer wanted to create their own app. And, you know, half the time they didn't even know what the heck they wanted the consumer to do with that app, but they wanted to be able to say they had one. Now, obviously, we've moved on past the basic apps, and they're adding more functionality, which is good, because the more functionality, the more a consumer can do, the questions they can answer, the more interactivity, the more they'll use it. It's a virtuous cycle. But I do think, you know, especially now what I'm seeing is the AI, you know, people feel like a panic of, oh, I need to say I'm using AI. I need to, you know, show that we're being smart about things. But again, if you're not clear on the problems you want to solve, what are the data sets you want to bring in? And are those data sets clean? And do you know how you're going to start drawing some inferences from that data? Then you're not quite ready. So again, I usually coach them to say, let's back up and look at what is the experience you're trying to do? What is the end result you're trying to achieve? And then we can start charting a path, you know, over time to get there, because again, the technology is available.
Mate, I love the technology treadmill, because, you know, that is so spot on. And, you know, for the record, I hate getting on the treadmill. I love running and I hate treadmills. I'm curious, you know, how are the banks responding? Because, you know, a lot of what we talk about is people need banking services. They don't necessarily need banks, right? I need to be able to conduct commerce. I need to be able to borrow. I need to be able to store wealth, and I need to manage risk. But nothing says I need a bank to do that. Yet the branch, the physical location, is the absolute manifestation of that physical presence, and it's impossible to kind of embed into other things, you know, in, like embedded commerce. So what do you think needs to change within banks and how they think about that physical location? Not just the technology they're putting in it.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of this is going to be smaller, you know, footprint locations, because you don't need the giant spaces you used to have. You don't have as many long lines. But second of all, that makes it feel, again, more intimate. And thinking about what are the types of services people are going to transact in person. Maybe it is opening up a brand new business account versus, you know, opening a transaction like a deposit. You're going to just do that now, you know, typically via an ATM or on your phone, you know, from the comfort of your home. So I think they can really look at how do we, you know, quote, make these more smaller, and in urban areas now looking at, do we need more different locations, because people aren't going to walk, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes to get to the bank. They want one like a Starbucks on every corner.
Go ahead, JP.
Well, I was just going to ask who you think is doing physical really well today, whether those are banks or credit unions or other retailers that you see. Who's best in class in your mind?
Well, I think from the big ones, I've seen a lot of experimentation from Chase. Again, and you look at their San Francisco offices, they've gone to, you know, what it was originally almost without any people, and now they've added back some humans and said, yeah, we don't want to be the autonomous bank. We want to have a human connection as well. Internationally, I've done a few meetings with Banco Santander, and they again take a very human approach to how they want to design these, and they've actually, in some banks, because the physical space just is what it is, and it's very large, they're starting to use the building space for other things beyond the bank. So things like a jam session place where musicians or poets can come in, again, very Spanish, kind of culturally that works, but don't know in the U.S. if we'd see a lot of poets jumping up to go give poetry at the bank. But, you know, I look at this and say they're getting creative. Now, on the other thing I would say is the credit unions and the smaller banks are more nimble and quick to respond. So I'm excited by some of the changes that are coming out of them, because I do think, again, they tend to know their user base, especially credit unions, because they're members and they usually have some sort of affiliation around why they've become members of that particular credit union.
Yeah, I agree with that. Well, if you were to start over and design the in-person banking services with a blank slate, where would you start?
Well, I think, again, it needs, for, at least for me, it would be a brand that's the not your typical bank, reaching out and being open and trustworthy. So things like couches and comfortable seating, and not a counter, not a desk, you know, not the big giant columns that are intimidating to a lot of folks. I think we're hearing from both millennials and soon digital natives, you know, who are getting old enough that they need bank accounts. There's a lot of desire to want to save and to start gaining that financial independence. And yet when we look at statistics, at least in the U.S., there's still a lot of people that are underbanked and underserved. So I would look at this and say, how do we include those folks? How do we get them to feel comfortable, get them to open up, ask the questions they need to ask so that they can be financially savvy enough to start saving, start making the right choices financially about their future.
Yeah, that's really good advice. And Michelle, we're going to have to leave it here because we've got a big show today. And thanks for joining us, not sure. only for your time, but particularly in the evening as you're in Germany. If you want to hear more from Michelle, do find Jason's FinTech 5 interview from just a few months ago. And she talked about Zelle as a leveling force in financial institutions, especially for smaller institutions. And she also talked about Bitcoin that was both the most promising yet overhyped technology, and definitely good to have her back on the show to talk more about that. So thanks for joining us. And I want to also thank Medici, formerly Let's Talk Payments. Now, they partner with FedFiz, the bank data specialist, to create the FI Data Pack, which provides proprietary ratings, financial metrics, and contacts for every bank and credit union in the U.S. So if you're trying to find the perfect financial institution for your next sale, use code PROVOKE for a special discount just for our listeners at gomedici.com/breakingbanks. That's Medici, M-E-D-I-C-I, gomedici.com/breakingbanks. Well, now it's time for us to take a short break. When we come back, Jason talks with Perry Ann Boring again about the recent hack of the CoinRail cryptocurrency exchange, and then he sits down with Mike Lavin, CEO of Currency Cloud. All of that is coming up right after this with more Breaking Banks.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the U.S. and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Very excited to have Perry Ann Boring, the founder and president of the Chamber of Digital Commerce, joining us today to catch up briefly on the news in the world of cryptocurrency. And as you've probably followed, there was a major heist of a South Korean exchange. Perry Ann, there's a lot of confusion going on about this right now. Why don't you break it down for us?
Yeah, so an exchange called CoinRail, which is based in South Korea, has reportedly lost about $42 million worth of tokens, cryptocurrency, from the platform. This was not a hack of Bitcoin itself. The technology is safe. Bitcoin has not been hacked. It was an exchange, a company that was providing exchange services that has been hacked. And I guess the key thing to take away here, one, CoinRail was the 95th largest exchange, crypto exchange in the world. So in other words, it's one of the smaller ones, one of the less kind of significant players in the market. And two, it really represents the breadth of the ecosystem. This is still a highly liquid industry. We've seen incredible growth in Bitcoin and the crypto markets over the past couple of years. This is still a thriving and healthy ecosystem. We will have setbacks along the way. It's part of building out a nascent ecosystem. But the important takeaway is that Bitcoin and blockchain technology is still safe. It's still operating. It's still working. There was just, you know, an individual company that had an issue. This is not unlike cyber attacks that have been experienced by other commercial entities in other industries. We created and published a report. We developed this with Microsoft. It's called Advancing Blockchain Security, and you can find that on our website. But the conclusion of the paper is that hacks typically are driven by people, not the technology itself. And this is not unique to Bitcoin. We've seen this in many other healthy and popular and safe industries over the years.
That's great. So give us 1 minute more. What should people be doing to protect themselves?
So the first rule of crypto, which I will credit Andreas Antonopoulos with writing this, and this is a quote from his book, Mastering Bitcoin. If you do not own your private keys, you do not own your Bitcoins. It's that simple. If you are putting your money in the hands of a third party, like the CoinRail exchange, you have lost control of your money. So it's really important that you understand the security of where you're keeping your crypto assets or your Bitcoin, and that you understand the risk of when you're allowing someone else to take custody of your coin. It's really a best practice in the crypto industry to not leave your crypto or your Bitcoin on an exchange. If you are going to use exchange services, the best practice would be to take the money off the exchange and to store it in a cold wallet or an offline wallet where you control the private keys that is not prone to this type of hacking. So there are much more safe ways to store your assets, and leaving them on an exchange is typically not a great approach. And if there is something wrong with the company, you're kind of at their mercy. So it is the user's responsibility to use a safe and reliable exchange and to take control of your private keys.
Fantastic. Thank you, Perianne, for joining us today. And we look forward to having Perianne much more regularly to talk as crypto news is breaking.
Thanks, Jason.
We've been discussing the evolution of the blockchain ecosystem. Perianne gave us some great context with the early entrants and where the ecosystem appears to be heading. We're now joined by Mike Lavin, CEO of Currency Cloud, the leading cloud-based cross-border B2B payments platform. And this is Mike's fifth time at the helm of a fintech or a tech company, which included Triana, the foreign exchange clearing network that connects thousands of banks, hedge funds, exchanges, and clearinghouses that was acquired by ICAP in 2009. Full disclosure, I've known Mike for, about 6 years now, Mike? Maybe seven?
Might be seven.
I think it's approaching seven. And I'm an investor in Currency Cloud, which means that enough with the small talk, let's jump right into the serious debate that Mike and I've been having for nearly a decade now. And so welcome to Breaking Banks, Mike. I want to pick up a conversation you and I had last year at Hacking Finance, hosted by Anthemis. Blockchain, AI, and augmented reality peppered the discussion for the entire week. And you dryly commented, as you often do, that in the closing hours, you're like, blockchain is going to change everything. Dramatic pause. It's just a question of in whose lifetime. To keep the quote right, a year later, we're almost up on hacking again. And can you provide some context to that?
Sure. Well, interestingly, I've just today actually come back from Money 2020 Europe. And for people who've been to the Money 2020 conference, it really does bring together the whole of fintechs, and it has become more bank-oriented over time as well. So I don't know how many thousands of people were at the European one. Las Vegas attracts 8,000 people, so it really was the fintech world. And there were, I think, a couple of major things that were going on there as trends that I think affect what you're just talking about. The first was what I would call is the silencing of the Bitcoin blockchain group. Is if 2 years ago at one of these major conferences, virtually every session you had to respond to someone from a crypto world and then from a blockchain world telling you it didn't matter what you said, but 2 years from now the world will be different, or if you're a big bank, you'll be dead, or your business will be transformed. And 2 years later, none of that's happened. Though there are important things that have gone on in the Bitcoin world, in the blockchain world, that transformation on a commercial basis hasn't occurred. I don't know, and you know, maybe people have a broader view of implemented applications, but I don't know of any major commercial implemented operating huge new open blockchain networks. Certainly, there's massive amounts of crypto, but it's very much a speculative currency. And booming on that basis. And that really, I think, changed the nature. It made the discussion easier. at the conference, because you didn't always have to respond to that there's only one technology future, which is a crypto / blockchain future. It's not that those things.
Hold on that for a second, because you used a very important word when you said open, because I think part of where we see the shift, because I don't know that we've shifted as fully in the US right now away from, certainly a lot more on the crypto side, that it's kind of taken out and it's become a world of its own. But when we look at the blockchain, you know, I'm actually seeing a lot of activity, but it's not the open. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that. Because where we're seeing it is actually either used solely within a single institution, a lot of them being some of the multinationals, or within closed networks. Did you see any of that? Is it just, has it moved from being the world of the startup to it is now another toolkit?
Yeah, so I have actually, in addition to fintech, I popped back and forth in my earlier days in the database world. And actually worked on a whole series of other database of distributed data problems. And blockchain as a solution for distributed data problems is actually a very interesting solution, not necessarily the only one. And so private closed loop networks where you solve basically reconciliation problems.
Yeah.
Remember, and in those kinds of networks, trust isn't necessarily the issue because they are private networks. So I think you're seeing, you know, just like whether it's R2 or R3, I can't remember, but you're seeing a lot of kind of development. And every day there's somebody who talks about they're going to be implementing a system inside their bank based on blockchain technology. I mean, eventually you'll start to see even a core banking system based on that. So there are, listen, we can read about all of those in the press, but what they are not is this massive global utopian transformation of the world financial system. What they are is important distributed data problems where trust and security is more important than transaction speed. And identity is an important one, you know, that whole smart contracts area. So you're seeing a lot of those kinds of closed loop applications. And I don't think, having spent a lot of time in the world of distributed data before that, blockchain is probably not the only solution for that, but it's an important solution. So the open part, I think, is quite important, and that's the sort of utopian vision. I think you and I have talked about this before in the world of Bitcoin, is that as a payment mechanism, unless every node on the network is on it, then it's actually not that helpful, because the last mile and the first mile, if they're not actually within the same closed loop world, then you're not saving any time or saving any money. So I think you've moved on to very important closed loop applications. We're also seeing payment service providers using underlying Bitcoin technology to do money transfers, which is great, which is a closed loop kind of thing, you know, USD to BTC, BTC to GBP, and then you get, with a synthetic currency, you can get movement. That works into a lot of emerging market economies where you might have a better Bitcoin, a better crypto presence than in terms of liquidity. I mean, I think, you know, the BitPesa idea of it, well, why should, when you're transferring money from Nairobi to Lagos, should you come back through USD? Maybe you can go through BTC as well. So I think there's a lot of really interesting applications there. But they're all small, they're all private, and they haven't taken over the world, and they're not going to in the near term either.
Well, let's talk about that again for a second, expand on some of the old line systems, right? So wire and ACH are already getting disrupted by API platforms such as Currency Cloud, Stripe, TransferWise, others, you know, modernizing that, disaggregating this idea that you don't embed the payment as part of a spread, right? It truly is, when crossing borders, becoming part of the payments. Do you see actually the crypto part of the blockchain? So think of it as crypto, not as an asset, not even really as a currency, but as a transmission vehicle. Is that going to fit in as just another pipe that sits below the system? Where do you see that going?
Well, remember that was one of the initial thinkings behind Ripple. That remember the euro dollar, which is how many things are valued outside of the U.S., is a synthetic currency. There isn't any euro dollar; it's just a synthetic currency. Same with the Asian dollar, and there's no reason why that synthetic currency should be the one that you use. Maybe you could use something else. The question that you have to ask there, and Ripple is a good example of that, would you rather have a synthetic currency that rolls up to a series of central bankers who come out of publicly elected governments, or a bunch of guys who started Ripple, no matter how good they are? And the answer to that is that the transmission mechanism being controlled in private hands rather than a series of public hands is probably not going to fly. So though you will see there's a couple of really interesting papers that came out recently from the St. Louis Fed, if you follow such a thing, where the St. Louis Fed basically wrote a paper that said we could provide our own synthetic currency by giving individuals accounts inside the central bank, which would then give them the same kind of electronic money that you would give them in terms of the crypto world. So I think that this synthetic use of cryptocurrencies to do money transfer is interesting. It can help where there's low liquidity or there's more liquidity in the crypto world than there may be in, you know, Nigerian to Kenyan or Ugandan to Laotian or something like that. So it might help there, but I can't see that being that massively transformative, and I'm not sure if we want it to be. Because if you remember, I don't know what the statistics are in Bitcoin, but the massive amount of Bitcoin is only controlled by a very small number of people.
Definitely has a concentration issue, which, you know, when we go to, you've heard my rant before, what makes for a good currency is stable value, ubiquitous acceptance, and it's backed by a fiat or something that you know has your back.
Yeah.
Well, when you don't know who holds that big chunk of the other piece, it impacts all three of those.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a worry. So it's a speculative trading commodity that, and as it's not tied to any underlying value, its ability to go up or down is relatively infinite. And to the extent that market is probably controlled by a series of, you know, people who have large positions who work on it, that's great. But that's exactly the kind of thing that we try to avoid in the world of securities trading. So there'll be lots of minor uses. There'll be important uses in trend going between developing countries or emerging markets where there's low liquidity. But I just don't see the kind of transformative area. But then there's other things that you're starting to see, whether it's Facebook dollars or other kinds of scrip where you're getting people, whether it's air miles. Remember, we traded air miles. There's a whole air mile economy, or there's also a whole minute economy in terms of
that's right.
Telefonica. And those are basically cryptocurrencies. You know, you can pay people's school fees in some places in the world by paying them in minutes. So there are going to be applications for synthetic currencies and cryptocurrencies that we haven't even thought about. And those are going to be really important, and they'll be an integral part of the world economy, but they aren't going to be it. Is how I think of the world anyway.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you bring up, was having this discussion with one of the founders of Air Canada's mileage program, which was the first of the air miles out there, right?
Right.
And he had brought up the analogy to, you know, hey, it was an alt currency, just like we're talking about. It didn't replace fiat currency. However, it has important implications in real value and real applications in ways that one wouldn't always expect. You brought up a really interesting part of this too, being there are certain parts of the world that don't have the double-edged sword of, you know, one of our challenges in the US is in Europe and Asia, in parts of it, is we have pretty well-developed systems. We're pretty good at moving payments across borders and relatively efficiently. But there are a lot of places where that isn't the case. That's probably where it's actually going to start to take deeper root.
Yeah, so listen, I mean, Currency Cloud is in the business of developing technology that helps a variety of payment firms and then ultimately small and medium businesses and consumers of moving money around the world. That can be moved at an instant speed and a minimal cost without the use of cryptocurrency or blockchain. So in terms of those advances, they actually don't add anything. In fact, right now, if you were to use most of the crypto sort of exchange systems, they actually cost more and take longer. Yeah. Though again, if you're in a closed loop, it's going to be fine. But if you're not in that closed loop, which most people aren't, then it doesn't work. So there's no cost or timing advantage there. On the other hand, but this is just a question of when you're moving something that's liquid and something that's not liquid. To the extent that you're moving between a currency pair that's not liquid, if you can have more liquidity in the cryptocurrency, but then remember, but if it's not liquid, then you might have technology issues in terms of instantaneously pricing and other kinds of things, or else it gets, you know, even when you move from Bitcoin from dollars to Bitcoin and then from Bitcoin to pounds or euro, there is still a time lag, which is enough of a time lag for an arbitrage opportunity. I mean, if you remember Michael Lewis's The Flash Boys, people were using nanoseconds to actually arbitrage time. So when you use a synthetic currency and you have to go through some other intermediary, there's always going to be a time lag. And a time lag introduces risk, and somebody has to pay for that risk. So as long as that risk is there, it's not going to be cheaper. Somebody has to own the price of that risk. That gets passed on to the consumer one way or the other. To the extent that I make a direct change from pounds to euros or dollars to pounds or dollars to yen, there are ways that and systems that I can have that I can actually hedge out that risk and not provide the consumer less risk than in the Bitcoin world. So I don't think that's the few. It can be an underlying mechanism for certain kinds of payments, but it's not going to be dominant. So that was the one thing about Money 2020. The other one I thought was pretty interesting too. So if we could move on from that one, as long as that's okay. The second thing I thought was quite interesting is this is particularly true in Europe about open banking. And remember, so in terms of open banking, the European regulation is that banks opening up the information inside someone's current account via an API, so that in theory, anyone who has there'll be some rules around it, but basically all that current account information will be open. And that's sort of not all there yet, but it's all moving in the right direction, and it will be there. I think the most interesting thing that's happened on that is a deal that Deutsche Bank did with the airlines, where Deutsche Bank, where the European national airlines said they would do a deal with Deutsche Bank where Deutsche would be effectively the conduit to the accounts of anyone in anywhere in the European banking system, and they would avoid the card world. So really, really a very interesting deal, and I think you're going to start to see open banking mean something very, very different than a bunch of fintech startups having better analytics in terms of top of people's current accounts. This was Deutsche Bank and the airlines, and you'll see certain things with the big retailers, with Amazon also hitting people's accounts in bypassing the card world. The other thing that you saw there.
On that part for a second, you know, if Amazon hadn't announced the Whole Foods acquisition the week before Dominic Ventura and I were doing a fireside for the ABA Payments Conference, and he and I had both come to the same conclusion that Amazon allowing you to ACH money into your Amazon account and store it, right? Like that should have been a game changer from a stock price perspective for the other traditional payment card networks, because suddenly, you know, I've got money in my Amazon account and they have tens of thousands of relationships with other merchants. You know, that's pretty significant from the card world perspective. And what you're now describing from an open banking perspective with other large commercial players being able to partner with banks of all sizes, you know, that has some pretty important implications for what the card world is going to look like.
Well, listen, you saw last year when it was the year before, maybe it took a year of regulatory approval, when MasterCard bought VocaLink. Especially in VocaLink, it's not just in the UK, it's also in the US and Singapore. Their technology is used in a number of other places for direct-to-account access. So one of those keys of open banking is this direct-to-account access bypassing the card world between sort of major pieces of infrastructure players and e-commerce. I think that's inevitable. The other part that was interesting in Money 2020 is the world of open banking in terms of the fintech world is being cut incredibly thin. You know, there's no interchange fee left. There is not much margin in the world of FX. And if you have a transaction that goes from someone's bank account and has a whole series of other providers in there who are aggregating and disaggregating, I'm not sure if there's margin for everybody. And so there's a lot of really clever technology that's being developed that's looking at that. And I think what you're going to see is really substantial consolidation, whether it's the banks acquiring all of those pieces and putting them all together. Because listen, the fintech world can innovate at a pace that's much faster than the banks, except as there's no margin left in the transaction, those companies can't be sustainable. So whether it's compliance or fraud and identity or reconciliation or account management or budgeting or all of the things in the value chain in terms of payments and lending, those are being really, really cut very, very thin. And those will start to be reaggregated just because there's not going to be money to sustain everybody. I'm not about to bet who the winners and losers are going to be, but there's probably going to be, you know, fewer winners than there are going to be than there are going to be losers, because you can't slice everything so thinly and have everybody get a piece of the pie. And I think that was one of my major impressions. The other thing is there's a lot of incredible work being done in fraud. Fraud and identity fraud and there's some blockchain work is there as well, where blockchain and identity is a big issue and can actually make a major impact. So that was the other impression of Money 2020. We actually did a physical booth count. We went around and counted what companies really did and as opposed to what they said they did. And we found that identity validation and fraud were actually the most represented of all of the various kinds of sort of fintech startup ideas that were there, which is actually good for us because it's an area that needs a lot of work.
Well, it's so severely broken, and it's one of the things that, you know, in my view, it isn't necessarily the speed aspect of conducting transactions, whether those be payments or doing other things. It's the fact that, you know, as you called it, the first mile in and the last mile out, maybe even not even the last mile, we're talking the first 100 yards, which is the trust, get me under the trailhead. And that's one of the hardest parts, whether it's opening an account or conducting a transaction. It's probably the only reason branches still exist.
You know, so this Currency Cloud, we have to have bank accounts all over the world in multiple currencies. And so we actually have a lot of accounts. I still have to come up with utility bills in my name so that the Currency Cloud can establish accounts in various banks all over the world. And we, because of our banking partners, still ask for multiple forms of identification, including utility bills, from various of the directors or our various of our B2B customers, and it drives me absolutely nuts. There's a better, more efficient, cheaper way to do it, but the world system hasn't moved there yet, and that's one thing where seeing work on identity, on fraud detection, whether it uses blockchain or anything else, that those are really important futures. And to the extent that we can get something that that consortiums of, remember, for those things to be effective, you need to have multiple players agree on data standards.
Yes, standardization, right? Without that, you're back to it only works within a closed loop.
Yeah. So, you know, listen, so if you can, in the world of white good appliance manufacturers agreed on a standard by which, in the terms of Internet of Things, all of the world's refrigerators can be connected, right? Yep. Buy a refrigerator or an air conditioner or a stove that's connected to the internet. They came up with a standard in the last 10 years. I'm not sure why we can't come up with one in the financial services industry that does the same.
Well, I can tell you why, because there's a small oligopoly of players who control so much of what little margin is left there. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't they continue to hold on to that for as long as possible?
Well, there's an effort in the UK. Remember, there's a, sort of like a semi-government, ultimately a quango, to try and establish a data standard among the banks, where the banks would all are paying for it and would subscribe to it. So it's neither industry nor government, sort of somewhere in the middle. And again, I'm not privy to what technology they're using to do that, but those kinds of efforts coupled with open banking can really democratize a lot of banking and make things very, very, very available.
Well, I think that's one of the things that will also be interesting right now, that we've opened Pandora's box with open banking in how this is going to work. And now that we have the open banking, I think the realization of we can't just say, let the data be free. It's like, oh, wait, we have to standardize now, too, if it's actually going to have utility in how we exchange it. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the open banking world. But America's so behind,
It's going to come crashing up on the shores. I've been talking about that more and more from the stage is, this whole idea of open banking and GDPR flustered and cluttered as our regulatory system and our fiefdoms can be in the United States, it's coming to us and it's going to be brought, in my view, by the big banks that are the big European banks that also have a presence here, because they're going to say, wait a second, I have to do it in the EU anyway or in the UK anyway. I see the utility of it. I'm going to start to do it here as well.
Right. So, you're starting to see that. I mean, every day I log on to some other website that I've been using forever, a US website, and I'm asked to go through what is effectively a GDPR consent check. So to the extent that information sites and e-commerce sites present globally, you choose the language, you choose the store, that may give you a different kind of, credit card or dynamic currency conversion or terms and conditions, but it's more or less a single instance or a single site. The GDPR and the consents are being built into that. So it actually, with the European, maybe the penalties may be different, but actually that standard is going to start to permeate. You just start to see it every single day, the things that you log into or the consents that you're being asked to give. And there's a restructuring that's happening there. We're at the beginning of it. We can only speculate right now of how those things are going to change.
Well, with about a minute left, we'd love for you to opine a little bit more, because we've talked a lot about, because of the value of the closed networks and the need to be at scale for a closed network to have value, that kind of tips the favor towards the incumbents who will look to the fintech startups as a source of innovation that they ultimately bring in. But doesn't standardization and openness also begin to level part of the playing field for these new players to reach scale?
Yeah, so listen, the existing players will always be constrained by how fast they can move. Not because they're bad people, but it's just that you're managing this massive infrastructure with huge amounts of interfaces and interconnections. And so moving a core system is hugely expensive and very, very time consuming. So they're always going to be slow. On the other hand, they have all the users. The fintech companies, of course, can be agile and nimble, both in terms of business model and in terms of technology. So, what we used to call sales is what we these days call, fintech bank cooperation. But mm-hmm. that used to just be very simply as you're trying to sell stuff to the big banks. You're going to need to see that. As the digital economy moves faster than the banks can move for regulatory reasons or system reasons. I mean, COBOL systems that I sold to banks 25 years ago are still in operation. Probably Fortran systems that I sold to banks even longer ago are still in operation. That stuff moves really slowly, and so that kind of institution just has an institutional constraint on not on how fast it can think, but on how fast it can actually do things. And we actually might like that, okay? That provides actually some degree of stability and some degree of permanence. So to the extent that agile thinkers can come up with new applications around the periphery, how those work inside the banking world is going to be incredibly important. But as I said before, there's not much margin left.
Yeah.
There's not much margin left for everybody.
You know, I've been talking more and more, and I know you're a regular listener, especially when I'm hosting, right, Mike?
Oh, when you're hosting, yeah.
Yeah, always when I'm hosting. But one of the ideas when we talk about breaking banks that I see, probably the biggest disruptor for 2018, 19, you know, call it Jason's 2020 vision, that biggest disruptor is actually going to be financial institutions. Might not be the biggest ones. It might be, you know, let's face it, JPM, Capital One, Wells are doing a pretty good job of disrupting the system. But there's also some really good smaller banks who say, wait a second, technologically, the playing field is getting leveled and I can be nimble and I can adopt these systems faster and I can hit way above my weight class.
Yeah. So listen, if the cost of technical innovation is so large that the big banks with billion-dollar budgets, on the one hand, have the money to spend, on the other hand, the institutional inertia that makes it difficult to spend it. If there are people in the middle who have less inertia, and then that could be very, very interesting. I don't think we haven't seen that yet. You know, there's experiments in the way that BBVA is putting together sort of challenger banks and innovative digital banks at a local level. And there, the American banking system is very different. I mean, there we have to worry about a whole series of relationship banking organizations that can't invest in digitization, yet provide a real community value. And yeah, if we lose all of that, just because in the terms of efficiency, then maybe we'll have lost something. So that's something also worth thinking about.
Yep, absolutely agree. Well, we are out of time.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks for bringing the insights from Money 2020 Europe.
Thank you, Jason. Always happy to do it.
Thanks.
Special thanks to Perianne Boring of the Chamber of Digital Commerce breaking down the hack of CoinRail, Michelle Tinsley in her expertise on the retail experience in the branch, and Mike Lavin of Currency Cloud on the last mile challenge in blockchain. If you like the show, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. This really helps others find the show. Even better, why don't you send them an episode? And don't forget, you can listen to all of our more than 200 shows, plus episodes from My FinTech 5 podcasts, Serial Entrepreneur with JP Nichols, and Breaking Banks, Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. And if you have a question, you want to comment, why don't you hit us up at BreakingBanks1 on Twitter. That's all for this week. We'll see you again next week with more on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.